David Bohm Seminar Series 1, November 7th, 1987, Saturday morning, 10 o'clock, Oak Grove School, Ojai, California.
Well, perhaps we can begin by, you know, if anybody wants to raise any questions from what was discussed last night, just to get some idea of how people are thinking.
Well, I don't have a question, but this morning I was thinking about what we said just before we left about the intention of being willing make seeing the illusion or our, what would we use, delusion, self-deception. And as I looked at it, I saw how deep self-deception went. It just seems to go on into infinity. And that to really look at it would probably require a gigantic disruption of my life. I mean, there's no place that I could see that there wasn't basically based on self-deception. And to sit here in this room and say, oh yes, I'm interested in discovering self-deception, and to realize that a monumental amount of energy and commitment and radical change that would require was sort of stunning to me to see that how deep it goes.
Yes. Well, self, it certainly is very pervasive. And if it goes all the way, then there's no possibility, right, of a change. Hmm? I mean, would you say it goes all the way into everything?
Well, it certainly seems to permeate every place I looked.
Mm-hmm.
But the one place it wasn't permeating was in the place that was looking me.
Mm-hmm. Are you sure of that?
Well, no. But the way it made me feel, I had a feeling that I must be looking fairly clearly, or I wouldn't feel quite so upset about it.
Yeah, well, that's a, you know, somewhere there's a feeling that it doesn't penetrate.
It was also, this lady had mentioned the Swiss cheese, and I thought about that, and I thought, well, if the self-deception is the whole, I could feel that there was something else besides the self-deception.
Mm-hmm.
There must be something else, or there would be.
Yes, there must have been something before we got into, you know, like, you can't assume the infant is born entirely with that, I suppose, or that it's built into us permanently.
Plus, there are so many other things happening in a human being besides just this.
Mm-hmm.
This aspect of consciousness and control, and I mean, my body doesn't seem to be deceiving itself, and that's also a part of my existence, and nature doesn't seem to be deceiving
mm-hmm.
me. And
yes, well, it seems that you know, just we're not deceiving ourselves in ordinary perception all that much, and in a great many areas we don't deceive ourselves, so we have to ask ourselves the question, you know, what are the areas where we do tend to deceive ourselves? I mean, for example, if I say that it's a door and I can walk through it, I don't deceive myself by saying it's, you know, it's not a door when it's not a door or something. No, I'd like to walk through and I say that's a door.
Okay. So there is an order or something that informs a person immediately if they're deceiving themselves.
At least at ordinary sense perception, with ordinary sorts of things you do, right?
Right.
You find out fairly quickly when you're deceiving yourself, for the most part.
Is that the speaker on? Maybe a little low in here.
People having trouble hearing?
Yeah.
All right. Is that any better?
Yeah.
Right. So I was saying that at least in ordinary, I think that's a little bit reverberating now. It's being lowered a little. How's that now? In ordinary perception, huh? Too loud still, it's reverberating still. Oh, it's too low. Huh? How's it now?
Still coming from your mouth instead of the speaker.
Just continue.
How, okay.
In the back and maybe give me a signal.
Is it okay now? Good? Right. Well, there's some limit to self-deception. In ordinary perception, it may operate sometimes, but not always. And in ordinary reasoning, it doesn't always operate, often doesn't. So there seems to be some area where it does operate. Oh. All right? Mm-hmm. All right, so what would you say the area is?
What area?
For self-deception.
Well, I'd like to use the word psychological, but that would be so nebulous as to maybe it's...
Yes, it's a little not quite clear, but could you define it a little better?
Well, it seems like I can only look at self-deception as how it operates. And it seems to always operate when I want something, when I have desires or investments, and it almost always seems to operate in the realm of the non-physical and psychological. Mm. It's difficult for me to call a board a piece of iron, or it's abstract. In the abstract, I don't quite know where.
But even in abstract mathematics, people, you know, generally don't deceive themselves. So it's not just a question of abstraction.
All right.
A great deal of abstraction is done in science. You know, there may be some deception, but it's not, you know, pervaded all the time. I think there's a particular area.
What do you?
It's the self image, right? It's the self, right? It's about yourself that you deceive yourself, basically, right? About whatever is interesting or important to yourself. Right?
All right. Hmm? More particular, to say, would be in those areas of your life and thought that produce feeling. Seems that part of what we try to do is feel good. When we have when something happens to threaten that good feeling, we use bad feelings. Then we try to cover it up with other thoughts that will negate that.
Yes, well, we want, that's part of the self-image, is to have good feelings, right? To think of yourself well and get good feelings. You see, certain thoughts will produce certain feelings, right? So if there are thoughts which produce bad feelings, you may tend to change them so as to produce good feelings, right? But that change may be deception, right? You know, for example, we would... we were discussing last night about self-deception itself, saying that we see somebody flattering himself. So we say, we are not like that, right? That produces a better feeling, right?
I woke this morning with some thoughts moving about, and I actually then questioned, you know, the origin of them at that moment, because it was linked with the fact that self-delusion seemed to operate mostly in the area of emotions, actually, not feeling. And you know, maybe the same thing, different words. And that it had to do with relationships with other people, other brains, who supported it. And it seemed that one lived on a desert island or wherever, alone, that this would have to dissolve. But the supportiveness of other people and images maintained it.
Yeah, certainly we require other people to support our illusions, right? But that's not true even with reality. You see, we have criteria for for reality. For example, we may say if this resists pushing, that's a sign that it's real, you see. If it's solid, it's a sign it's real. You know, if it acts on its own, it's a sign that it's real. Hmm? And if other people, if everybody agrees, that's a sign that it's real. Hmm? Right? So, if we have some doubt about our image, saying, you know, I would like to have a good image, so I think, okay, I've done all these things well, but then I may be a little doubtful, so I want other people to say the same thing. That helps to show it's real, right? If everybody will say the same thing, then I could assume it's real. You see, so that's a very important test for reality, right? It can also be very deceptive. Everybody can agree on something that's entirely false, right? So every one of these tests for reality is not safe, right? You see, is that clear? But in a dream, they're all satisfied, and it's not real, right?
Is reality a fact?
Well, I'm trying to say reality, the real thing. You see, the word real means thing in Latin, right? It's res is thing, and it's based on a verb rere, to think, which means what you can think about. The thing that you think about is real, right? The thought perhaps is not real, but the thing you think about is real. If it's really there. If it's just a thought, then you say it's not real. For example, you may think of anything here, say that there's a chair in the middle of this space. You can easily think that or imagine that, but it's not real. Now, there's a psychologist, Piaget, who has said that some young children, when they're first learning, think that their thoughts are visible to other people in the middle of the room. They then learn they're not visible to other people, and that helps them convince them that they're not real. If everybody said, "I see this chair that in the middle of the room," you would say, "It seems to be a real chair." Of course, everybody could be deluded, right? Not about chairs, that's not likely, although it can happen, but about things like other questions, you know, like what's right, what's good, you know, or what's beautiful and so on, you know, all sorts of questions where people can all agree and fool themselves. Right? So I'm saying that there are tests for reality. You see, we have a distinction of imagination and reality, or fantasy and reality, right? In fantasy, you can imagine yourself doing all sorts of things, right? And like Walter Mitty, remember the story? He was sort of almost living in that world of fantasy. Now, how do you distinguish between fantasy and reality? In the dream, it goes all the way, right? Some sort of construction of the thought is experienced as real. Or sometimes people have hallucinations and so on. But now, we have tests for reality. You see, perhaps one of the ideas of psychologists is that very young children begin to first form an image of themselves through remembering their past experience, which makes a kind of fantasy, right? So their consciousness of themselves is through this fantasy, right, of the body and so on, the feelings. Right? And then at some stage they learn to distinguish fantasy from reality. But in a way it's a kind of another kind of fantasy, which is called reality, right? That kind of thought. It corresponds in some sense to what actually happens, you see. But you then have tests for it, like saying that the real thing is going to do certain things which the fantasy doesn't do, right? Now, this is important because we're going to say that this test, it is possible to fantasize the satisfaction of the test for reality, right? Right, and therefore produce illusion. Is that clear? You see, when it comes to subtle things, you can easily do that. I mean, can you think of some examples?
You mean on the physical level or the psychological level?
Well, any level you like.
Well, it seems like the whole function of thought is to have, as we know it, is to have a reality, quote, and that reality is constantly being proved because everybody else has the reality.
Well, we also test it by yourself. You see, you say, is it solid? You know, does it stand up?
But we give it that solidness. It doesn't seem to have any... I mean, like we have living in a physical world, we say, yes, okay, that's real. I'm not imagining that. Somehow we go inside our head and we'll have this thought, and you say, it's real because I feel it.
Yes, okay, that's a good point. You say, so what's an example?
Almost anything, I think. Fear of the Russians, hatred of a race, desire for some
stock market.
Yeah, well, that's a complicated thing because you see, there is something going on, but in addition, something that people fantasize. See, the stock market is based on belief, they say, and something real is going on, which is based on fantasy, right?
Wasn't that the case with the slavery in the United States? The South fantasized one thing and saw one reality. And the North saw another reality.
Well, that's true all around. You see that, you know, it's happening all over right now. Let's say the East sees one reality and the West another, and the North another, and the South another. and so on.
These are all psychological realities.
Yeah, but they're sort of penetrate into physical reality,
right,
too.
The way to prove your psychological reality is to make it somehow change the physical world to fit it.
Yes, or to fit in. You see, there's a... See, that I want to discuss now, as we move between fantasy and reality, you see, that there's a process called attribution of qualities. You see, we can attribute solidity to the microphone, you see, expecting it to be solid and feel it to be solid, right? You see, suppose, though we haven't tested it. Mm-hmm. Now, suppose you're watching a television program and you hear a telephone bell ring, you see, and if you see a telephone in the image, you will attribute the sound of the bell to the image. So you will experience a telephone ringing, but actually there's no telephone and no ring, right? Nothing is, it's just spots of light and electronic impulses producing sounds, right? Mm-hmm. But you experience a telephone, right? If nobody gets up to answer the phone, if there's no phone there, you may question that attribution and say it may be your own phone ringing in the next room, right? You attribute it there, and you may have to move and test to see which one is the real, is real, right? Now, is it a real fantasy, or is it a real telephone? You see, fantasy is real, right? You see, this distinction of fantasy and reality is very subtle. We can't just draw a line and say, you know, here's fantasy and here's reality, right?
Could we say that the brain is almost incapable of making that distinction?
It's obvious. It's quite capable. I mean, in the case of the telephone ringing in the television image, you know exactly how to make it, right?
Well, then why did it get confused in the first place?
Where is it confused? I say it's certainly not confused in problems like that. You see, it may for momentarily confused, but not basically, right?
Well, when one's watching TV, one often gets confused or forgets that they're watching a fantasy.
Yes. Well, that's another thing. But I'm saying that the first point is that the brain is quite capable of distinguishing between fantasy and reality, right? But it also, you have to notice to make that clear that fantasy is in itself a real process.
Also, what do you mean by that?
Something is going on when you're fantasizing.
Oh, okay.
It's not, you know, see this distinction saying it's either real or unreal is too sharp. Is that clear? Because if somebody is fantasizing something, something is really going on. He may have pictures in his mind, he may have emotions, right? The blood may change, you know, the adrenaline, the chemistry. So fantasy is a kind of reality, but a kind in which you make a wrong interpretation of what it means, right? You don't, if you are having a fantasy and know it's a fantasy, then you are seeing what it really is, right? If you have fantasy and say it's reality, then you have made a mistake, right? Which makes an illusion. Huh?
Mm-hmm. Well, the scientists use this when Tesla saw in his remarkable imagination this alternating current motor. He saw it work in his mind. He was fantasizing, but it was apparently quite accurate because he went ahead and built the motor from it.
Yes, that's a very good point. You see that we have to distinguish two kinds of imagination. One we'll call it fantasy, which means the reworking of known images in various combinations, and the other I'll call it creative imagination, which may have a rather different source, right? Where it's the beginning of the perception of something new, right? Now, we have to say there may be some grade in between them, but there are roughly two areas, right? Mm-hmm. And so we have to be careful not to throw out the imagination and say it's all bad, right? Mm.
Where I call it three-dimensional thought. You can use a computer to make a boat, you know, you draw, you put it in from all angles. Your intention to think something out is for this three-dimensional world. And then the other fantasy, which I call further up, is just for your own entertainment. You don't wish to do anything from it, you know. Like watching television, I can use my imagination even more entertainingly than I can television.
Yes, well, you can use it for your entertainment, or you can use it usefully, because if you imagine how to change the furniture in the room, that's still fantasy, you see. It's a useful form of fantasy, a kind of imagination. And then there's the creative imagination we were talking about. Now, so we have all these kinds of imagination, and the important point is to be clear as to what they are. You see, the mistake arises if something imaginary is taken as real, right? if you attribute reality to what is an imagination.
But there's a catch to that, because the picture of this room and the people in it that I have right now is awfully close to being a television screen, because the information is coming out from the outside, is converted into electrical impulses in the nerves, and is created into a picture in the brain. And so what I'm actually looking at out here is awfully close to being a television screen.
Yes, it is, and that's what I'm trying to say, that there is no such thing as pure fantasy or pure reality in our experience, right? Every experience contains a certain element of fantasy, which is filled in. The things that you don't actually know are being filled in, as you haven't verified every little thing that you see, right? Mm-hmm. So that's being filled in probably from past knowledge and so on, right? So you see certain points and the rest are filled in, and that often may lead to mistakes that you can correct, you see. So there's no sharp distinction of these two, but still, you may have, it's important what your attitude is to all this, right? One attitude is to say that if I see some disagreement between this construction and my experience, I will acknowledge that it may be wrong and correct it. Mm. Another attitude is to say, if I see a disagreement, I will not acknowledge that it's wrong, but I will impose this as my notion of reality, right?
I think what you said is, you may be going a little bit too quickly over it.
Right.
Because what he's essentially saying is that no matter what we look at, I mean, even though we, with a general sweep of the hand, we say, well, this room is real, I mean, he's pointing out that actually the room is also part of our imagination.
It's not there are all sorts of sensory cues which are helping to build this picture of the room, you see.
Right.
Which is based, however, partly on past experience, right, the way you organize it, right?
Even the room that each of us builds, so to speak, I mean, it has certain aspects in common, but it's happened to me, probably happened to us all, where someone will point out something, you know, some beautiful arrangement of colors or flowers, and then you actually haven't seen it until someone points it out, because it's not your habit, perhaps, to pay attention to those things. And sure, you could have seen it, but it really wasn't there in your picture of the world.
Yes.
And so what I'm hinting at is that there is no reality to which we can compare our fantasy, because it's all a fantasy.
Well, that's right. I say it's all a fantasy, but one part of it we call reality.
We call that.
But it has a certain quality. In order to be called reality, it we require certain qualities.
Well, it has certain qualities, but we can't, you know, as Hume was fond of saying, there's no way we can be certain of any of those qualities.
Well, there's no absolute certainty here, but you see, I'm saying that the thing is that the question is that we are constantly testing our picture of reality, you see, against experience.
Right? I don't mean to stop you all the time, but the test seems, one test comes with the continued existence. If your idea of reality doesn't match with, you know, what's out there, it may very quickly lead to your death or demise. So that anybody who continues to exist, and in particular I'm inferring, say, our human race, in some sense, we must be doing something right, because, you know, we do keep on procreating and carrying on, although maybe in the long run, as you were suggesting yesterday, it will prove that our idea of reality is not going to prevail. We may disappear.
Is having decide, you know, when this talk says confusion of mind, how do we decide whether to bring something in one's mind into reality and when not to? Because there's a population explosion problem. You could imagine you're married with 10 children, and thought is from moment to moment, and you get tired of things. Why not just imagine you've got a family?
Well, yes. Yes. You see, I want to suggest that we don't ever decide this. You see, I want to say something about the nature of thought, that thought works on its own. We have, one of our fantasies is that we control thought. This is an important one. Actually, thought controls us. Now, that is closer to the reality, that this decision does not actually determine the issue, you see. Say that I think if we go too closely into the nature of fantasy and reality, we are going to get off into a very complicated question, which may not be the point really at issue here. I merely wanted to emphasize that that between fantasy and reality, there is no very sharp line. We are constructing some picture of reality, and it's constantly being tested. The fact that we survive is not a proof of its correctness. In the jungle, it might be, but in society, people are protected by each other against the consequences of their false views. And therefore, you merely say you're able to survive in a society where people will do this, you see, which as soon as you got into some more jungle situation or some other situation, then you would be either not survive or forced to change. So the I really want to say now that thought contains this element of fantasy, and a part of it we call reality, which has been tested fairly well against experience, and it could be mistaken, and the attitude is very important. Whether you're ready to test this constantly and acknowledge mistakes, or whether you want to hold on to those images which are pleasing to you and feel secure, and therefore push out, begin to ignore the experience which doesn't agree, right? Begin to deny that it has happened, or reinterpret it and say it was all right, and so on. In other words, self-deception, right? So one of the questions of self-deception is on just the question of fantasy and reality, that we, in order to get good feelings, we may take the attitude that if there is some discrepancy in experience, we either deny that it's there or explain it away or something, and go on with the more pleasing image. Yeah, that's a very one of the forms of self-deception, right? Now, one of the questions is, why do we do this? We were doing that while discussing that last night. We really need to get into some understanding of why we do this strange behavior. You see, why should we want to have a pleasing image? We can say, all right, I have a pleasing image, I enjoy these images, that's perfectly all right, I can entertain myself. But why do I insist on thinking they are real and causing myself a tremendous amount of trouble and not making myself happy at all? In other words, for one moment of good feeling, I may pay a tremendous amount of suffering because of my saying that these images are real.
Self-deception might not be based on pleasure. It might have a deeper source. I mean, self-deception just doesn't arise spontaneously. It must have, and we must have some reason to continue in this that's deeper than just maintaining a self-deception.
Yes, there must be something deeper, and that's what we want to get into, you see. Now, so I think we need to go further into the nature of thought, you see. That is, we have the fact that thought can attribute all sorts of qualities to things and experience, and you experience them that way. In other words, your fantasy sort of can penetrate into reality by saying this is good or that is bad or this is solid or that is a telephone bell ringing or something. And and in fact, that's the very way in which you do things that are right, too, because you say this is a microphone and this is a floor and so on. And the important difference is in the attitude. What is your attitude as you're doing it, right? So that comes back to the self, you see, to say to me.
Are you asking why, or not why, but pointing out that we have, through this last conversation we've been having here, it's pretty obvious, I think, that we have the wrong attitude in a very dangerous way, and that this attitude has prevailed for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And that we, in examining it, have to find out what it is about thought that creates and maintains this wrong attitude.
Yes. What is it that does so? I'm proposing that something in thought is involved there, you see. Now, an attitude is a disposition, you see. Suppose you are walking on a road and you assume it's level. Your body is disposed accordingly, and if you meet a pothole, you'll trip. But if you from then on, you will think the road is not level; it has holes, and you will have a different attitude, a different disposition of the body, right?
Yeah.
So the attitude depends on assumptions.
It also depends on the fact that I've had an experience that is informing me.
Yeah.
I'm constantly. It seems to me, in that kind of a mode, I'm being constantly informed I mean, if I'm walking through a busy city, I never assume that I don't have to pay attention to the traffic.
No, but you may assume that the sidewalk is level. You see, it's a perfectly good sidewalk, but there may be various irregularities.
But as soon as I was informed by my environment, I would start.
Yeah, as soon as you trip, then you would say, okay, this sidewalk is probably not regular, and I have to watch, right?
And why aren't we being informed psychologically?
Yes, and others, I'm saying not only we're not being informed, but I think we have the attitude that we don't want to be informed. Mm-hmm. We want to conceal it, right?
As you often said, the world must be for me what I need it to be. And to keep the equilibrium, the inner equilibrium or the inner feeling of everything being comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And within that comfort zone, it seems to me that the concept or the feeling is about what constitutes for me, what is and is not me, what's absolutely necessary
mm-hmm.
for me comes into play there.
Yes, all those things come in there. You see that the... Now, I think one of the points I'd like to look at is, the way in which, we have a kind of assumption that thought is produced by me. Right? Hmm? I decide what to think and when to think and when to carry out the thought. And in other words, thought has no effects except what I decide to give them, right? That's a common assumption. Thought operates in a kind of vacuum. Ethereal domain, and the real world is affected by thought only when I decide to make it so. Right? Is that clear? A common assumption. And vice versa, if something is happening outside, it does not affect my thought except when I decide to let it affect it. Right? So I'm thinking thought is one thing, and the rest of the world is another, including emotions and the state of the body and everything else. Right? A kind of different distinction. Right? Now, this is not correct. It goes against all that we know, not only in science, but from just common experience, right? That by thinking, you can affect your whole body, right? For example, if you see a shadow in a dark night and you think this is an assailant, the adrenaline is, the heartbeat is going, the muscles are tense, you may be sweating. Also, the whole system is operating, right? Just by the thought, this is an assailant. As soon as you say it, no, it turns out to be a shadow, that all stops, right? Hmm? So that any thought which is at all important will certainly mobilize the whole system. And vice versa, when the system is mobilized, the thought is affected. You see, if you're frightened or angry, your thought will no longer be straight. Hmm? So that's going in a cycle between thought and the rest of the world, right? If you also say something to somebody else and they answer you back and so on, that cycle is extended out into society.
Well, there's also this biofeedback thing in which people can put themselves into alpha brainwave, theta brainwave, and the less I heard, they succeeded in so somebody trained themselves until they can make a single cell fire.
Yes, that's true.
This is quite remarkable. So what do you make of that? I mean, where do you fit it in?
Well, that's part of what I'm saying, that
yeah.
You see, that thought is, the idea of saying thought is one thing and the rest is another is a very serious mistake, which misleads us very badly. You see, we'll try to see how. You see, that, for example, we'll just go into that illustration you just made, that you see, there's a device called a polygraph, which will measure the resistance of your skin. Now, see, if your autonomic nervous system is excited, then you may start to sweat a little bit and the skin resistance changes, the electrical resistance. Now, see, so if you're connected up to this machine, now if somebody says something that disturbs you, roughly 3 seconds later, there appears the needle moves. it takes 3 seconds to go down and affect the autonomic nervous system. Now, if it's point is, though, that by the time that happens, you have forgotten the thought which has made it move. Right? Hmm? You perhaps never knew about it anyway. And 3 seconds later, therefore, you say, I'm all stirred up. I have a gut feeling, which is very important, right? Hmm? Then you say something, I've got to do something about this. You see, so in order to do something, I must first think, what shall I do? What's going on? So 3 seconds later, you get a more powerful gut feeling. And it builds up in a cycle, you see, it runaway feedback loop. Right? You see, so now, This may happen, for example, when you're angry, right? You say, he did something terrible to me, it was outrageous, you know. And 3 seconds later, it's all stirred up. And then you think some more, and it gets stirred up some more, and it can go on and on, huh? Now, this is a misconception about thought. Now, this is very interesting, that what we think about thought is not just an idle matter, but it has a very powerful effect on everything. Right? We may say it's important what we think about energy conservation and pollution and the way this world runs and so on. That's true, but what we think about thought is much closer to the source of the problem. Right? If we have the wrong notion of thought, it is going to muddle everything we do all around. Because the thought that we use out there is going to be affected by what we think about thought, right?
Is what we think about thought something conscious? Do we think
it may not even be conscious. Sometimes it is, but it's often just tacit, right? Mm-hmm. If we pick it up from the whole culture, what thought is supposed to be, right? We may pick up the notion from the culture, nobody ever told us, but from just the way people behave, that thought is independent, and that I just decide when thought is going to have an effect, right? Now, because of that mistake, if somebody insults me, I think, you know, that was outrageous, and 3 seconds later, I'm all aroused, and I cannot help that. I didn't choose to make it happen, right? And I've made a mistake about that. If I said this is just a mechanical arousal because I thought how outrageous it is, then I would say, well, okay, this is nothing but an extension of the thought I had 3 seconds ago, so it doesn't add any more information that I already had, right? Therefore, it's not that important, right? I already know exactly what this means. It doesn't add anything. But on the other hand, if I don't see the connection, if I have the assumption that thought has no effect, then I say, if this is here, it couldn't be due to thought, because I already know, and everybody knows, and what everybody knows is true, that thought has no effect, right? Therefore, this couldn't be due to thought, since thought has no effect, it's well known. And therefore, it must be due to a gut feeling, which is very deep and powerful, and, you know, it shows that my instincts have shown me that something terrible has happened, and I must do something.
Well, that thing you can see when it's something like anger, something that's really very obvious. But the thoughts, this process continues whether you think it's something, whether you value the thoughts or whatever, your body is interacting with it anyway. Right?
It's always going on, but the value you have is the important point. You see, if this is important, it's going to arouse the system, and if it's unimportant, it's just make a minor ripple, right?
Minor ripples are cumulative.
They may be. That's another problem. But the major point is not that, but rather the mistake that has been made, the mistake that you did not see the connection to the thought. Right? That turns the whole meaning around upside down. You see, if you saw that connection, you would immediately know that it's not important. No more important than the thought was 3 seconds ago.
And where did that thought come from?
It may have come from another disturbance which happened 3 seconds before that, right? You know, we don't know. Thoughts move around. It's the origin of thought. We'll have to try to discuss that, but it sort of goes from one thing to another. You never quite find where it started, right?
Perhaps, David, the thought is a name, a memory structure that we attach to the actual physical feelings which we've experienced before we had any thought memory structure.
Well, it may be partly that, but thought goes further than that, since by means of thought we have built this whole world.
Of course, but I'm trying to get back to your connection between emotion and thought. You see, in the infant, when I'm born, the two hemispheres are not connected. There's no corpus callosum in existence. It's just a mass of jelly-like material, which will ultimately myelate into 200 million nerve fibers connecting the two hemispheres. So as an infant, I have the right hemisphere operating with the eyes, ears, nose, all the senses. I have the left hemisphere working with all the senses. But there's no connection between the two hemispheres, so I'm like a split-brain person.
That's an assumption.
No, it's not an assumption. This is brain research
fact, not an assumption. Now the question is, how do I perceive as a young child, not Krishna Murti's perception, but how do I see things and feel things as an infant under those circumstances? I haven't learned any language, so I have no, I would suggest that perhaps I have no left hemisphere memory structure. In fact, I think if you look at it, you'll find you can't remember anything prior to your language structure. Not your speaking structure, but your language structure. So here I am a child, and let's say my father is attacking my mother, but I don't feel that I'm separate from my mother. So I'm looking, my right hemisphere is feeding all this information in, not degraded by processing it through the language processor. So I'm getting my 25 million bits per second coming in through the eyeball, impinging through the right hemisphere. And where does that get stored? I would suggest that this stored, from my insights, in the musculature nervous system. So I learn fear, I learn avarice, I learn jealousy before I'm able to ever learn what my mother and father were talking about. Then I learn to name that feeling, which is stored as emotion, I would call it, is a frozen set of, my emotions are just conditioning. They're conditioning in the body, stored in the body, from the right hemisphere, which is my perceptive organ anyway. Then I ultimately name those when my father tells me, that's fear, that's pleasure. He tells me that like he tells me, this is green and that's gray. I learn what these things are. And now I have a word memory, and I would say that my left hemisphere memory structure is based on words. And I don't have any of that memory structure until I'm, 6 years old. I begin to understand what these words, my mother says, that's your mouth, that's a cup. I can't speak because the vocal cords aren't fully developed, so that's the only reason I can't speak.
Well, what's the function of all this information?
So what I'm trying to suggest to you is that's one of the reasons we cannot make connection to this feeling of emotion, which are frozen memories of all of our psychological conditioning.
Some emotions, huh? Or all
emotions? All emotions. I learned by the age of 6 months all emotions.
Are you saying we haven't, inherited any of the animal emotions?
No, because you're the father that threatened my mother and that you've taught me.
For one, I'm not the father that threatened your mother.
Okay.
For one, I don't want you saying that. For two, I'm not sure of anything what you're saying is accurate because I don't know how they can ever find out what a childhood experience is. And two, three, is we already, whatever the truth of what happened to us is what we brought to this room and how we maintain it and how we're going to disassemble it, they take it apart, is what we need to discover, right? Not how it came into being in a theoretical way.
Of course, but if you understand where it came from, perhaps you can see why thinking about it, for example, cannot, and this explains perhaps why no thought action can ever erase my condition, my emotional condition.
What if I didn't have any feelings about it?
I say you don't have much choice about feeling. You see the trauma of being attacked as a child.
Well, there are all kinds of feelings, assuming that only traumatic feelings exist, you see.
Well, it can be pleasurable feelings, too.
Yeah, I mean, but there may be feelings which are very subtle and which, you know, are neither pleasure nor fear. You see, and also, as we were saying, the animals have these feelings, too, and one can see fear in dogs and cats and so on, and there's a certain instinctive fear which we actually need and may have been built into the system. Yeah. Well, it's not. I wonder if we can usefully discuss this at this point because, at least for most of us, we don't know the facts behind this and how to judge them. So.
He seems to be presenting the idea.
What?
He seems to be presenting the idea that perhaps something occurred very early on in the organism that was before the kind of mode we're interacting with now. Thinking and the approaches we're using, something occurred very early on, upon which all of our perception and cognition and so on was built. And that might not be unimportant, might be useful to examine that and see if that played a role as an origin or a source, regardless of whether the hypothesis is correct about exactly how it came about. whether or not that might be playing a role in the source of the confusion and the constant repetition of patterns we find ourselves in as adults.
Well, it may be. You see that you know, that all sorts of experiences we had earlier are affecting us still.
Is he suggesting a few really primary experiences have major effects on patterns that we have a tendency to repeat and have very, very difficulty in connecting to? Understanding.
Isn't one of our problems that we're once again taking this episode called childhood and divorcing it from everything else? I mean, we'd have to go back and see what the mother was doing while we were in the womb, and then we'd have to go back and see our genetic history, and then we, I mean, the whole history of the universe is inferred.
If you use this as a psychologist tries to use it, I'm suggesting that maybe if we can understand the physics of how the human being actually operates.
But we would have to understand then the genetics, and we would have to understand, we would, in order to...
All we'd have to do is see that I'm conditioned, that I was conditioned very early, that I was not conditioned with word structure, I was conditioned by actual physical actions.
I'm agreeing with that statement,
now,
but I'm saying that physical actions didn't start with birth.
So can I be aware, therefore, that any thinking about it, which is Krishna Murthy's point out for years, is of no real value in erasing conditioning.
Well, then let's forget about erasing it and just understand.
Yes, so I have to understand it from perception.
Now, how will you go about that?
Well, that's what we're all here for.
Yeah, but I mean it. Yes, let me present the difficulty that I see. That you say, I don't know whether what you say is true or not. It could well be. But I don't. From here, I would say we don't know how to proceed because we say words are no use. You see, we're here to talk. What shall we do? I'm trying to say that it seems to be no way into this. As a psychologist, you might try to analyze the person, try to get him to remember, you know, and you don't seem to be in favor of that. Now, so I want to suggest all of that may be so, but is there another way into this? That's what I'm raising, that the words may not get to this. Words, there's a whole series of defenses, one after another, you see. The first defense are the words. If you don't get past the verbal defense, you will never get to that. That's what I'm trying to say. The words are, by themselves, are enough to throw you off. Simply you're saying, I don't have this problem at all, a very simple set of words, which will stop the whole inquiry, right? So, therefore, I'm saying we have got to begin by looking at the way the words work, which in fact we have visible before us, if we will pay some attention. And then we may discover, having got past the verbal confusion and defenses, that there's more, right? Our minds are open to that, right? But see, the thing we don't notice is the very words with which we start to confront the problem are stopping us. And I don't say this is intrinsic in language. You see, if we say it is, then we're stuck. I'm saying we need to pay attention to this way it's working, that words are not merely conveying meaning, but they are working in a certain way on our whole neurophysiological system. Yeah.
Well, it's one thing that makes the situation even worse, just to be helpful. If you try to observe yourself thinking, there will be no thought. What I mean is, we say we have to look into these things, we have to observe what we're doing and all kinds of stuff, but if you actually try to catch yourself thinking, my experience is that you can't do it.
No, that's quite true. You see, that's where we're going to have to do something else.
That's right.
Yes.
You're saying, in other words, that thought precludes perception.
And that's what he does. It stops it.
Stops the perception.
And so, as if you're trying to watch the process of thought so that you can get somewhere with this procedure, that won't work, but obviously perhaps something else will, I guess, at this point.
So I'm trying to say that, look, what do you mean by watching the process of thought? That already contains a large number of traps, you see. Suppose I say, here, I am thinking, you see. So suppose we begin by saying, I'm angry, right? Suppose I'm angry, And I say, I'm angry, because I have good reason to be angry. You know, I was treated very outrageously and so on, right? And now, as long as I have a good reason to be angry, I cannot stop being angry, right? Now, whatever I think of that good reason, 3 seconds later it will be all stirred up, and that will be proof to me that I'm still angry and so on, right? Now, okay, so now I say, okay, I begin to see that this anger is no use, it's not, doesn't make sense, and I'd like to get rid of it, right? It would be much better if I were free of it. So I say, look, I've got to watch it. So I say, the first thing is, what am I going to do? I begin with the statement, I am angry. Now that already makes it impossible to do anything, you see? Because what does it mean? You see, it means that I am here, somewhere back here, the anger is something else. I say, this is wooden, you see? So I say, here am I, seeing that this is wooden, right? That's a fairly good idea here, because my thought is fairly independent of this object and the object of the thought. So we can make a separation and say, there is me who is thinking about this and there is this, right? And this is wooden, because I've seen it and so on, I know it. And now I say it's a similar problem with anger. It only happens to be about me and not about this object. The object is me, right?
That's why it doesn't work.
Yes, but why doesn't it work? You see, sometimes it does. If I say this is my leg, it works, right? If I say I am talking, it works, right?
If you're not emotionally tied up with your leg or the wood.
Yes, but why should emotions create that problem? You see, this is we have to understand, you see, that. So I say that I think there's more than an emotional problem. There's a structural problem, which is deeper than the emotional problem. That the emotional problem would not cause this problem if we understood the structure of what was going on. It is because of a misunderstanding of the structure that the emotions attain such significance. Like if you are faced with an assailant in the dark night, you have powerful emotions, but they are not the problem. The problem is there an assailant or isn't there one? If his shadow is attributed as assailant, that makes the emotions. So therefore, there is a problem of the correctness of your thought, first of all. Now, there's a right structure if I say this is a wooden object, and I'm looking at it. And there's a wrong structure if I say this is anger going on inside this object, and I'm looking at it. Why is it wrong? I can say my stomach is upset, it's all right. You know, I have a toothache, that's all right. But I have been hurt by you, that seems to be wrong. You see, my tooth hurts is all right. I can even have a lot of emotions about it. I don't like that toothache and so on, you see. But there's a mistake going on, a very serious mistake, you see, which is that I am saying that I, who am looking at one object, and the thing I'm looking at is independent, another object, right? Anger, me being angry, right? I can say, I can for certain purposes split myself in two and say, this is me looking at my hand or looking at my toothache or whatever, but it doesn't seem to work when I say, this is me looking at anger or being hurt, right? Because the connection is different. You see, the anger is not separable from the thought which sustains the anger. So I am angry. It's not just a thought about anger, which is like saying this is wooden, is not just, it doesn't affect this very much, you see. If I say this is made of wood, or this is brown, or whatever the color is. If I say I am angry, then it's the same as saying the telephone bell is ringing in the image, you see. Or the telephone bell is ringing in the next room, right? I experience it according to the way I say it, right? So I attribute, that thought attributes anger to an entity, me, who is separate from the observer of the anger, who is also me. That's all right, the fact that it's both me, but because it can be done in many cases. But it's wrong here because the thought is too intimately connected with the thing which you're thinking about. Exactly. And it's a cycle. The division is incorrect.
David, are you saying observation is action?
Yes, it is, but that's a further step, you see. I'm trying to get clear the structure first, you see. That is, thought is action, too. See, the first thing to understand is every thought has an effect. Therefore, we make the distinction of thinking and action. That is already a mistake, a very serious mistake, because thought is action, right? It affects the whole body, it affects everything. Now, therefore, observation is also action, you see. Now, but let's begin with thought, right? I'm saying, I am thinking, I am angry, and I must stop being angry. But I also have another thought, which is I have good reason to be angry.
Then you could go on and say, inaction is action.
Inaction is another kind of action. You see, this is an idea which is common in the East, but not in the West. You see that the Tao says, you know, that it praises inaction as the highest form of action, that the sage keeps to the deed which consists in no action, right? And that sounds like a paradox, but it is if you look at it in a certain way. But what it means is that a certain kind of action which is irrelevant is not taking place, so that the really deep and significant action can take place, right? So therefore, inaction is just another word for a certain kind of action. Now, so but if we separate action and inaction, we have made another kind of mistake of separating things that are inseparable. Therefore, you see, there's a mistake going on, and through that, if that mistake is not corrected, nothing that you do about the emotions can alter anything. It doesn't matter where your emotions come from or how far back they go. As long as you make that mistake, you're stuck. That you are saying that anger is different from the thought of anger, and that there's an entity called me who is thinking the thought of anger, and another part of that entity has to be changed, right? See, like saying, I am an entity. I may have a cut on my leg, and I've got to look at that cut and, you know, heal it, right? Put some medicine on. So I say, I've been hurt by you who have treated me outrageously. I am, therefore, I have very good reason to be angry. Now, as long as that thought goes on, there is nothing you can do to stop being angry. You may say, I ought not to be angry because it's foolish, it's stupid, it's immoral, it's everything. But you now have just two thoughts going on. One says, I have good reason to be angry, and the other says, I should not be angry. Well, that's just chaos, right?
You're saying that there's not two thoughts.
It's all one process.
Somehow we have a mechanism that keeps splitting it into small.
There's no mechanism. It isn't split any more than the telephone is split between the telephone in the next room and the telephone in the image. You see, nothing happens to anything except the thought is wrong, and that muddles the whole process, right?
And the wrongness is that it keeps trying to split itself into smaller and smaller things.
It's not trying to do anything. It is presenting something which is not true, and the whole system operates according to what is presented as true, right? You see, you may try to make an image. I'll make a sort of a picture that the whole system is watching what you're thinking and acting accordingly. If you present a wrong picture of what is, the system is going to be muddled up, right? You see, that happens very often in ordinary life, that you have a wrong notion of what you're handling and you get all confused, right? You know, you're surprised suddenly that things don't work the way they should, right?
Like grabbing an empty pot and full of water.
You're going to pick it up with a tremendous energy right up in the air, you see. So you have an inappropriate action because you have a wrong notion of what it is, right? Now, therefore, I'm saying this thought is a wrong notion of what is going on, a wrong notion of what is inside of us or wherever. And this thought is that there are two of us. One of us, there's the entity who is angry and the entity who is looking. And we experience it that way, but just as we experience that telephone bell in the image when there's no telephone, so we can experience these two entities when there are no entities, right?
So what keeps us from seeing that that is the telephone?
Well, that was quite a long story, so I'm trying to, right. Yeah. What?
That's
merely a metaphor, right?
So if you couple it and juxtapose it with what the gentleman said a few minutes ago about if I want to watch thoughts in action, I can't do it.
It's the other way around. Your whole system is watching thought, but it's accepting it as true and acting accordingly.
Sort kind of exists without duality. Which has only anger and sin, there is no thought. And in action, anger transforms. Because it has inaction, action takes only place when I'm separate from thought, from anger. It's a two of them.
Yes, the problem is why that it does, nothing happens to most people when you say that, you see. You see, not able to follow it through. But we'll discuss it later, right?